Don't know me, I think we may have one or two in here. I'm Cliff Garrison, retired engineer from the Boeing Company. I've lived in Seattle a number of years, I've been away a number of years. My lovely wife Barbara of 41 years or so, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to live in Turkey for 5 years as an engineer with the Boeing Company. This was really a wonderful experience. We were there living on what we call the economy, where we lived in an apartment in the town among the Turkish people. Barbara learned Turkish so she could shop in the little stores and converse, because so many of those people did not speak English at all. We also had the opportunity to travel extensively throughout the Turkish country, which is, incidentally, is a fabulous place to live and visit. And there we had, were able to consummate our basic goal to get to know the Turkish people pretty well. Turkey is about 98% Muslim, so most of the people we associated with who were native Turkish people were of the Muslim faith. I was site manager for Boeing operation, or deputy site manager at the Air Force Base in Adana down in the Mediterranean. And we had about 1,200 Turkish employees, and was later transferred to Istanbul with the responsibility of site manager for 5 army operations, and we had about 170 Turkish employees there. So we got to know them pretty well, and as a general rule, I can say without any fear or hesitation at all that they are lovely and outstanding people. Delightful to know, wonderful to work with, and just as nice as you can possibly expect. And in that context, I would like to read from an introduction to an excellent book on understanding Islam. It can put this into focus, the mistaken concept that many of us have that the Muslim people are terrorists, that they're out to do all the Western world the harm that they possibly can. This introduction reads, "A casual reader of the daily newspaper should be forgiven for thinking that the word Muslim is an adjective used to explain violent events in remote parts of the world that are otherwise incomprehensible. Muslim leftists have made war in Lebanon, Muslim separatists did rebel in the Philippines, and Muslim insurgents did fight government troops in Afghanistan, and a Muslim cleric demands the death of a British novelist. Muslim extremists did assassinate officials in Syria and make trouble in Nigeria. This journalistic shorthand, however, is misleading, unfair, and potentially dangerous because it distorts our understanding. It fosters the impression that all Muslims, that is, those who practice the religion of Islam, are generally troublemaking fanatics whose penchant for working out religious conflicts through violence is a menace to the rest of the world. It oversimplifies complex events in which religion is only one element, and it validates the belief that Islam promotes violence, which is at best a half-truth. And it belittles those Africans, Arabs, and Asians by imputing to them primitive or irrational motivations that we may not subscribe to the participants of violent upheavals in non-Muslim countries." The House of Islam embraces nearly 900 million people of every race, from Senegal to China, and from Nigeria and Africa into and through the Soviet Union. And more than 2 million Americans are Muslims today, and it's a very fast-growing group in America. All are Muslims sharing common religious beliefs, but they vary widely in behavior. Most of these people are not Muslim fanatics, they are not leftists, they are not revolutionaries, are extremists. And they cannot be stereotyped in the image of one race or one kind of political or social conduct. So what I think I'm going to say here is that Muslim people are like us. Pretty much the broad spectrum like us. We say Christians are not extremists. Christians don't do too many things wrong, but if we looked at the population of our prisons and asked the prisoners there what faith they are, I would suspect that about 75% more or less would profess to be practicing Christians. So I think the message here is to look at the Muslim world as like us. There are some people who are pretty tough, but there are a lot of them who are beautiful. With that little introduction, I'd like to kind of outline how I would like to proceed this afternoon with a couple of
Would you repeat how many Muslims are
in over 2 million.
Okay.
Over 2 million. And incidentally, there's a very large mosque in Washington, D.C., and one which is free to visit if they would like. We're going to talk a little bit about what the conditions were in the area where the Muslim faith was started, around Mecca and Medina on the western edge of the Saudi Peninsula. What were those circumstances at the time Muhammad was born and lived? That puts a lot of focus on how we got to where we are today, and also gives us some feel of the miracle that the Muslim faith was to be able to be created and to go through all the ramifications to where it is today. We want to highlight the life of Muhammad himself. Where did he come from? What did he do? How did he get where he is? And what was his thinking? What was his lifestyle? Then we want to review some of the tenets of Islam. What does it really mean? And then we'll have a question and answer session afterwards. I promise myself and you that I will keep this extremely short. My wife feels like I talk too much, and I really do. So I have a clock up here, without the alarm, but we'll keep it short. Let's look at some definitions, because we can get wrapped around the axle if we don't look at definitions and we get them out of context. When a Muslim refers to Allah, which they do, that is the Arabic word for God. And the Muslim people believe that their faith, and we'll get into this more in detail, is a continuation of the Jewish tradition. And their God is the same God of the Jews and the same God that we worship. So they use the word Allah, but it is interchangeable with the word God to them. Islam is the name of the religion, as Christianity is to us. It is the religion itself, and it is an Arabic word that means submit. And the whole focus of the Islamic religion is a submission to the will of God. A person who practices Islam is a Muslim. So we need to keep those words in focus. What is Islam and what is a Muslim? A comparison would be that Islam is comparable to our word Christianity, and a Muslim is comparable to our word Christian. So if we can keep that focus, it'll make a little more sense where we're going this afternoon. But a Muslim, then, is a person who submits that there is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. And that's all he has to do, and that's all he has to say to become a Muslim, is to believe that sentence there. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. And we'll expand on this theme just a little bit more. So if you understand this, then it'll be a little more clear, I think, as we go through. So let's think now in the context of what were the conditions in this world about the 6th century. The birth of Muhammad is generally accepted as 570 AD, but it is not fully known, and there's no guarantee that that's the precise year, but it's in that general
timeframe. So the 6th century Arabian Peninsula was a world of desert, camels, very little prosperity, wandering tribes, and caravans that were bringing the goods from India as far as China, through this part of Arabia, up in through the Holy Land to Syria, and from there on into the European world. So Muhammad was born into this environment here. The thing that characterizes this area also is it was composed primarily of nomadic tribesmen who moved around. There was the business element in the cities, but it was very minor compared to the tribal activity and the tribal way of life. It's important to know that the tribal leaders were those that were selected because of their knowledge and skill and leadership qualities. There was no line of succession for our leadership of a given tribe, and that point is very important that we realize that the tribal people in those days selected their leaders based on skill and ability. Whether he was a son of a previous tribal chieftain did not make much difference. So that becomes a very important point to us. So let's take a look at Muhammad. Where did he come from, and what did he do, and how did he get this tremendous thing going called the religion of Islam? And it's quite a fairy tale. It's an interesting story. And if this is any interest to you at all, let me suggest you might get another book and read a little more in depth of what we can cover here. We're just going to hit the high spots, because in an hour, there's not very much we can pick up on. But he was born about 570 AD to very poor parents who were in the business element of Mecca. His father died before he was born, and his mother died when he was 7 years old. And he was raised by a grandfather, and this grandfather died when Muhammad was 9 years old. So you see, he started out pretty low on the totem pole, as we say here. But he was raised by an uncle in Mecca. He is said to have been a very handsome young man, a very strong young man, a very intelligent young man, and he gravitated to be in the caravan business. Some of the caravans going through here consisted of 1,000 camels heading up the coast into this part of the world. And it took a wise and smart and competent person to handle that kind of responsibility. So that was the function and focus of Muhammad in his younger years. But it also gave him the opportunity to be associated with the Jewish communities that existed along this part of the Arabic Peninsula, and also to know some of the Christian settlements that were in this lower part of the Holy Land at that time. So he was able to get quite an education into the Jewish faith and also into the Christian faith as he moved back and forth through those areas where those people were. He married a woman by the name of Khadijah when he was 25 and she was 40 years old. And she was a very wealthy woman who had been impressed by his skill at handling the business element and was very glad to have him not only as a husband but as a business manager for her business. But he seemed to make a point of trying to learn as much as he could about the Jewish and Christian faith on his travels up and down the peninsula. But he became somewhat, I think we might call him a mystic along these early years, and would retire to a cave outside of Mecca to contemplate and to try to get things in perspective for himself. The Arabian people were polytheistic. They worshipped a whole multitude of gods. They did not have any single deity that was more paramount than any other. They had some practices that were abhorrent to us today. They normally killed their infant girls. And the word debauchery was the name of the game in those particular areas. And that bothered Mohammed a lot. One day in this cave, he had a vision. And an angel came to him and said words to him, recite. Recite in the name of your Lord who created man. Recite that your Lord is the most bountiful one who by the pen taught man what he did not know. And this was the start of Mohammed's really thinking about, hey, there's a better way of doing this. So he started building on this theme. And he had other revelations as time went along. But he always maintained that the revelations that he was given and the words that were given to him to say were direct from God. And these were compiled. He was illiterate in the 15 years after his death into a book called Quran, K-O-R-A-N, which is the Islamic Bible. It's about half as thick as our New Testament. The Muslim believes, and we'll get into this a little further, that the words that Muhammad put, or had put, or were put into the Quran are the direct words of God. And that's where we get that Muhammad is the messenger of God. A true Muslim does not attach any divinity to Muhammad at all. He is merely the vehicle, the messenger, that through the revelations from God, he was able to put those into words that people could read and understand. So he started a small preaching type of activity, but he had very little success. In 3 years, he had only 30 converts into his religion. These people, including Muhammad, were terribly persecuted by the ruling tribe of Mecca because they saw in him several problems, even at this early stage. Because he was promoting one God versus many, the merchants in Mecca felt that they were undermining their business because they were promoting all of these various gods and having pilgrims come in from the various outlying areas to worship this God and that God and that God. They were also afraid that if he became successful, he would be a competitor to them for prestige and power, another person that they would have to contend with in their running of that particular realm of the country. So he was stoned at one time, his people were beaten at one time. In fact, it became so bad that at one time, all of the people moved over into Ethiopia for about 2 years. And he continued on to this, but it became so bad that he listened to a delegation from the town of Yathrib, which is 280 miles north of Mecca, who were having some real problems trying to reconcile the differences between three distinct groups up there. And Mohammed had shown a lot of skill in administration, in solving problems and bringing people together in a limited sense with his organization in Mecca. So they invited him to come to Yathrib, which he did. He took his converts up there, and through his skill and abilities, he was able to bring these warring factions together and through that skill and administrative ability, he became pretty much the administrator of that particular town. And that was his real base. He changed the name of Yathrib to Medina, and that's what it's known as today. The way they raised money was to raid the caravans that came through of rival factions. One of the elements of this were that the people who participated in the caravan raid shared in the booty. So when this became an organized entity, he was able to bring more people in to his organization because they shared in the booty, which was certainly a thing to do. His wife and his uncle died in 619, and his organization was going a little bit better by then. At one time, the people from Mecca thought they would put a stop to this caravan raiding and brought an army of about 1,000 people up here to wipe out Muhammad's people, who by now had gotten to be a rather large organization and were very warlike, and had enlisted some people from up north into their group who were much better warriors and fighters and strategists. So Muhammad's group of about 300 annihilated 1,000 of the warriors up from Mecca, which enhanced the prestige of Muhammad, and he was able to say that God was on their side. So he was able, from this kind of thing, to bring a rather large number of people into his organization. He established two principles early on into this religious program that he was sponsoring. One was that Islam was an all-encompassing religion. We think of Christianity basically as a spiritual religion and exercise. To Muhammad, he wanted, and it is today, that Islam addressed all facets of life, not just the spiritual, but the physical as well. Marriage, business, law, administration, every facet of America, of the life of an individual is included in this religious principle, so that the spiritual leader was also the governmental leader. And this was a point too that the Meccan people could not accept. Neither could they accept the fact that the religion that Muhammad was expounding recognized the poor people and said that they should be given consideration and that the wealthy people should be considered and supportive of the poor. This attracted the poor again. So from these points, he was able to amass a very large organization in Medina. At one time, Mecca says, we're going to have to put this thing to bed once and for all. So they sent an army of about 10,000 up there. And again, Muhammad was able to conquer this group and establish himself a little bit more, or at least to protect his base in Medina. So as time went on, within the next year or two, his goal had always been to reestablish himself in Mecca. So he took a group of people, unarmed, and went to Mecca with the intent of being on a pilgrimage. And by then, his group had grown large, his knowledge had been expanded out throughout the area, and he was able to make the pilgrimage to a holy place in Mecca without any problems. The next year, he came there with an army of about 15,000. And when the natives of Mecca saw this force outside their area, they realized it was futile to continue combating this. So they were able to enter Mecca. He took over Mecca, both the spiritual and the administrative end of it. And that was how he got established into Mecca. He immediately destroyed all of the idols except one, which is the stone in the Kaaba. And this is about a 12-inch volcanic type stone that is believed to be a meteorite that's been worshipped since the early part of the first century. And they believe, the Arabic people there, that this was part of Abraham's house of worship and was built by him. And it's incorporated in the place where the people who are making the pilgrimage today go. So we see now that he was able to build a very large organization. He was able to get it established. He was able to have it accepted. He was able to eliminate most of the warring factions that opposed this organization. So let's talk a little bit about Islam and just what it means and how it's put together. Remember that we're talking about the religion itself. It has no central doctrinal authority. There is nothing between the individual and his God. There is no pope, there is no bishop, there is no intermediary anywhere. There is no sacraments, and there are no priesthoods. And all Muslims are equal before God. And this was a bitter pill for the non-Muslims in that era to accept. They do not accept the fact of original sin. Therefore, there's no entry requirements, and you cannot be excommunicated, which is a little bit different to them from us. It does have its conceptual roots in Judaism and Christianity. They do think that they're continuing this Judeo-Christian tradition, but are correcting it because of the errors that have creeped in through translation errors, new language areas, and perhaps some errors on the part of people who are in this religion itself. They believe that Patriarch Abraham visited Mecca, and it is the one true religion since Abraham. They don't have too many problems with the Jewish faith because it is rather simplistic and it has most of the features that the Muslims adopted. The problem they have with Christian faith is that to them, God is, and we'll get into this a little more a little later, is a one. He has no father, he has no mother, he has no children. They do not accept the triage or the Holy Trinity that we accept here. They do look upon Jesus as a major prophet. He is written up in the Quran, as is Mary, but they do not accept the divinity of him as we do. They do look upon, there are four major prophets that have been instrumental in recording the revelations of God. The Pentateuch was Moses. They accept what Moses has said and done, the Psalms by David, the Gospel by Jesus, and the Quran by Muhammad. But they do feel that these earlier revelations do contain errors as they were brought down to the 6th and 7th century of the Arabia Peninsula. In the Quran, they say that Noah, Jesus, and Abraham observed this faith and were to be united into it. And this is part of the Quran. Their basic beliefs are fairly few and fairly simplistic too. They do believe that God, on the last day of judgment, will judge each person on his or her acts. There can be no intermediary that can pray for you. There can be no intermediary that can help expiate your sins. That whatever you have done, there you will stand up and be counted at the last day. There will be a resurrection. And for that reason, the Turks, who do not have much embalming, feel that the bodies will come back in pretty much their present state, so they have a practice of burying people as close after death as they possibly can. Those who pass God's test can be admitted to paradise, which to the Arabic people is being in a garden with flowing streams, with fruit and honey, and being waited on by black-eyed virgins or young boys. Or the converse of that is condemned to eternal fire. And they describe some of the most horrible, horrible things that can happen to you if you opt for that route. They believe that God is just, but also merciful, and you can repent when the favor of God. But each Muslim today knows what he must do in this life to be admitted to what they call paradise, or it probably corresponds somewhat to our word of heaven. He must accept one God. He must accept Muhammad as God's messenger, and God's message as revealed to Muhammad. And he must pray, and he must be honest, he must be truthful, he must practice mercy, charity, live modestly. He must avoid arrogance and slander, and defend the faith against unbelievers, which is not an awful lot unlike our religion. It's interesting to see what some of the attributes that are applicable to God in the Islamic faith. First of all, he has no physical attributes. But he's not a spirit. He has no age, shape, mother, appetite. But again, he's not an abstraction either. He has an immediate and a constant presence. And he knows all thoughts and needs. He knows all who follows his command. And his commands are acceptance of Muhammad's message, social justice, personal honesty, and restraint. And since he's not physical, and this is real interesting too to us, they do not allow any portraits or statues of him. There's never a picture that anyone could look at that would say, this is a picture of God in the Muslim faith. In some old miniatures, when they're trying to put a message across, they will show a human form that could be God, and it will usually have fire as the face. And they don't have too many representations in some areas of Muhammad for that same reason. And his face is blanked out. And he did not allow any pictures in their mosque at all, or any statuary in the mosque. But they all believe that God created the earth and the heavens and all the elements of the earth and mankind and the angels also. As we said, all of the words that came down to Muhammad from God were collected after his death and put into the Quran. And the Muslims believe that this is the literal words of God, and that there is a duplicate of this in heaven, and that there can never be any change in this. It can never be re-edited. It can never be have any interpretation that it differs at all from the original Arabic writing. In fact, it was not translated for a long, long time. I think the first English translation came out about in the 1700s. And that translation is frowned upon very violently by the Muslims because they think it was written to discredit the Muslim religion. So the Quran is in Arabic, and most all the references to the Quran and the readings of the Quran and the prayers from the Quran are prayed in Arabic. It is the fundamental source. The Quran is the fundamental source of all Islamic thought and doctrine. It's all-encompassing. It is complete. It can show you the total way to treat your life. There is one feature that came about, and the words and direction from the Quran are rather broad brush in some instances. So there is a secondary book called a Hadith, which is a compilation of the words and practices of Muhammad relative to religious practices. And it does cover every part of the life of a Muslim person. After Muhammad's death, there developed the five pillars of faith, and these are the basis of the Muslim religion, are the that what the Muslims must do. First of all, he must publicly profess his faith, which he does every time he prays. The second thing is the ritual prayer. A Muslim will pray five times a day, in morning, forenoon, noon, afternoon, and evening. He faces toward Mecca, wherever he may be, and this is an unusual but very common sight to see a Muslim praying at the appointed time. They stop whatever they're doing. They may have a prayer rug, or they may have a piece of cardboard, or they may have a reed mat, or they may be on the ground, and they're facing toward Mecca, and their head down, and they touch their forehead, and say their prayers five times a day. Friday noon is the corporate prayer when they go to the mosque. There's a ritual cleansing that each one must do. This is more symbolic than actual, but as they go into the mosque has fountains outside the courtyard, and they take off their shoes and they wash their feet to the ankles, their hands to the elbows, and their face in water. They go into the mosque barefooted, leaving their shoes out, and they line up in rows as they enter. And there is no reserved seats for the wealthy. There is no special pews for a choir, for example. They're trying to stress the commonality of man. And the prayer may be led by someone. They do not have a priesthood, with one exception we'll discuss a little later. But there would be corporate prayers and individual prayers. Women are not allowed, or they are not encouraged, to come to the Friday services. You may see a few, but if you do, they're in the back, up high, screened by a lattice. The zakat of the tax. This was imposed by Muhammad to further his work and to pay somewhat for the church. This is separate from any income tax they may pay to support their government. This supports their charitable work, it pays the tax collector, and it also is used to further the Muslim faith. It used to be an animal, or food, or produce from their garden or vineyards. Today it runs about 2.5% of their wealth once a year. The fourth pillar of faith is fasting. And this is very interesting. The Quran features and highlights the need to control your own body, to be subservient and not be completely devoted to food, devoted to any excess. The fasting comes in the month of Ramadan, and the Muslim calendar is divided into 12 months. It follows the lunar cycle, and every 20 years they add 11 days so that they keep in touch with the seasons. But Ramadan is one of the holy months of the year in which every Muslim must fast from sunrise to sunset. That means no food, no liquid, no smoking, and no pleasure of the flesh, as is written. The sunrise is determined by whether you can differentiate between a black thread and a white thread. And same way with sunset. We had an interesting incident when we were traveling up in central Turkey from Cappadocia and staying at this little hotel in a little village up there. And at 2:30 in the morning, I heard this god-awful noise out in the street. And it was a flute and a big drum. And it would go boom, 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 boom. And these two guys, men, were walking down this little street. The next morning at breakfast, I said, what was happening last night? It's so unusual. We've been traveling a lot in Turkey. We've never been getting rid of this. But we were aware that it was Ramadan. He said, these are the guys that wake up the cooks. Because the cooks have to prepare the meal, serve it, the people have to eat it before daybreak. And then when the evening comes, it is almost an orgy of eating. And they will eat until midnight. And you wonder how they do this. We had a couple of families across the street from our apartment, and it was almost a party after sundown during the month of Ramadan. Our employees had a very difficult time because the lunar days travel throughout the year, so Ramadan can fall in July as well as in December. In Adana, it gets 115 in the shade. I don't know what it gets in the sun. But you have to be very cautious and very considerate of your people. Because in the summer, the days can be 16 hours long. And to go without water for 16 hours is very stressful, to say the least. So they pretty much set their own pace, and they do got what they want to do. And you don't worry too much about forcing to get things done during the month of Ramadan. There is a big feast after Ramadan, the last day. And this is usually where they will kill a sheep and share part of that with the poor. They should give at least half of it to the poor. And we had an interesting incident here in that we lived in this apartment on the Marmara, and we had on the first floor, it had a little garden of flowers and ground. And one of our neighbors asked Barbara if we would mind bringing his shuk, as he said. He didn't speak English too well. We visualized that it would be one of the boats that they would launch from the dock there and go fishing, which we did. Wonderful, wonderful. And about an hour later, we saw this man leading this sheep to our backyard, which they wanted to slaughter. There's something in the Quran that the leftovers have to be buried a minimum of what?
40 centimeters.
40 centimeters. And that's a hygiene thing, which is no problem about that. But they had no place to bury the leftovers, so we found them in our garden, which was just fine. This has nothing to do with the Muslim faith, but they had a unique way of getting the hide off of the sheep. They slit its throat and let it bleed, and then they take a tire pump and make a little opening in the skin at the front foot and pump it up, and that hide just separates from the flesh, and pretty soon it's this big around, where the sheep is about that big around. And so it's very easy to get off. These are professional butchers that travel from home to home, and they're in and out within about 10 minutes. But it was something we learned very quickly. The last pillar of faith is a pilgrimage. Now this is not an annual affair, but once in a lifetime, a Muslim is expected to and hopes he can make a pilgrimage to Mecca. And there are literally millions who do this. And Saudi, with their wealth from oil, have been able to control this, and they have built a huge open-air pavilion to accommodate the hundreds of thousands of people who come. And the ritual takes about 4 days. There is a ritual cleaning. They must wear white sheets, a lower and an upper cloth, so that the humanity is equal. There is no evidence of wealth. And they march around the Kaaba 7 times. They try to kiss the holy stone. They throw little stones at an idol, which has a biblical history. And the whole operation takes about 4 days. And it's something that everyone works very hard in order to accomplish. Let's see where we are today in Islam. Muhammad died and did not leave a successor identified. And this has caused all kinds of problems, even today. They needed someone to pick up the administrative load of furthering the progress of the faith, and they call it a caliph. So we have what is known as the caliphate. The caliph has nothing to do with the spiritual end of it. He strictly is an administrator to look at the day-to-day operation of, we want to call it the faith, that's fine. But the caliph is not a spiritual leader. He's strictly an administrative type. So the followers that were close to Muhammad appointed one of the early 30 people by the name of Abu Bakr. And they appointed him because he had demonstrated leadership qualities. He was highly competent, and they felt that through his skill, they could further the propagation of the faith. He died 2 years later, and they went through the same process and selected a man by the name of Umar as the caliph. And he served for 10 years and was assassinated. So the leadership went through the same process of selecting the person they felt most qualified, and his name was Uthman. He served for 12 years, and he later was assassinated. Here's where the problem comes in today. Muhammad's daughter married a man by the name of Ali. And a lot of people thought up here that Ali should have been the caliph because he was the blood relative by marriage of Muhammad. So that section of the Muslim people felt that the succession should be hierarchical. It should be bloodlines as contrasted to the traditional way in the desert of selecting the most competent individual. So these people were probably instrumental in the assassination of Uthman. But anyway, Ali became the fourth caliph. And he reigned for about 5 years as caliph. And his son Hassan became caliph. But these people did not really accept this line of succession at all. So they continued pretty much as they had before. And Hassan was assassinated, and a man by the name of Muawiyah, who was governor of Syria, became the caliph on this line. And he moved the headquarters from Mecca to Damascus. And here is where we have the division of Muslims between the Sunni and the Shiites. And it continues today. The Sunnis are the main line of the Muslim faith. The Shiites are basically Iran. There are some in Afghanistan and some in Turkey. But basically, this is the main line of faith. The Shiites have adopted some practices that are a little bit foreign to what these people are. They have a person that fills the role of Khomeini. He's an imam, and he is a spiritual leader. And while he does not theoretically come between the person and his God, he does wield a lot of influence and does get pretty much into the spiritual element. Whereas Sunni do not have that office at all. The caliphate existed for about until about 12 or 1300 as a real entity that functioned. After that, because of the war and the movement and the changes of headquarters, it just became more or less a title and nothing more. The sultans of Turkey, of the Ottoman Empire, were by definition and by title the caliph as well as the sultan. The last sultan was deposed after World War I, and with him went the office of the caliph completely. So today, these organizations have some splinter groups that fall off from them. But basically, most of the world is this way, and Iran takes care of the bulk of the Shiite people. I have one other little point I'd like to share with you.
Who heads up the administration of the Sunni now? I mean, is that...
It's local.
Oh, it's a local.
Local. Completely local. Lebanon has about 30% Shiites. Iraq has about 50%. Pakistan about 15%. And in Iran, it is the official language, the official religion. We had some people working for me who lived out in the extremely western part of Turkey, near the Iranian border, and there are some Shiites in that part of Turkey, and some of my people were Shiites and some were Sunni. And there is a conflict there. It's very unpleasant to be into that. So these people are not the greatest of friends even today. We see the Sunni mostly in North Africa, Egypt, Syria, and Pakistan. Iran is looking for the 11th Imam. The 10th one followed this line, and that was the end of it. The caliph in this line from Ali. So they think the 11th is there somewhere in the world, and they're looking for his resurrection. Now, how this came about, I don't certainly understand. So they're continually looking for the 12th Imam to come back down to earth and rescue them from any of the travail they may have. The Iranian Shiites seem to be a little more devoted to martyrdom. And they do believe in saints. They've elevated Ali, and they've elevated Muhammad to sainthood. They're very revolutionary in their thinking, and they're definitely anti-Western. There's one other thing that has a very significant impact here. At one of Muhammad's visions, when he was in Mecca, he was taken up to Jerusalem. And from there he went into heaven and visited Jesus and visited Abraham and all of the other patriarchs and all the prophets and saw God. And he came back to earth and was returned to Mecca. That is believed in by most of the Muslims today. Some believe that it was strictly a visionary thing. Others believe that it physically occurred. But the spinoff of that act was to designate Jerusalem as a holy city to the Islamic people. So Jerusalem is the third holy city to the Muslim people behind Mecca, Medina, and the now Jerusalem. This causes an awful lot of problems because when the division of Jerusalem was made, the mosque there was not in territory that was accessible to the Muslim people, the Palestinians primarily. So that has been resolved, but the fact that Jerusalem is a holy city puts our current Holy Land into a very precarious situation. So that pretty much wraps up my part of the program. We have run over my allotted time, 2 minutes. The rest of the time on your time. I'm here all afternoon. Barbara, I didn't go over an hour. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I'm capable of. Yes, sir.
The Iraqis, they evidently are Sunni.
Yes.
Right? Yes. And that's why they and the Shiites are loggerheads.
That's right. And now it seems to be a reconciliation.
What about these Kurds? What are they?
The Kurds and the Armenians are Christians.
Oh, they're Christians. Oh.
And that's another problem.
Yeah, that's
another problem. Yes, sir.
What kind do we have in the States?
They're Sunni. About the only Shiites you find are in the Iran.
Oh.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Can you ask some hint of why the Muslims are so hated in Yugoslavia?
Let me bring us to back to square one is why I'm up here today talking to you about this Muslim religion. I believe very strongly that the biblical direction of all of us is to get understanding. And the Muslim question, to my way of thinking, is one of the most crucial things that we have to address today. Either by the luck of the draw of being in a particular place, are having a particular attitude, we find the Muslims involved in most of the trouble spots for the world. Certainly the Middle East, pitting the Palestinians, which are 100% Muslim, against the Israelis and against the practices and policies of the United States, is a serious situation. The point you brought up is an excellent one. The people of Bosnia and Herzegovina are 40% Muslim. And these hatreds go back to the 7th, 8th, and 9th, and 10th centuries. And they seem to be unsolvable. The problem is that the boundaries established by as a nation do not correspond with the ethnic boundaries. And even if they did, you can't divide a country where you have 40% of this and 30% of this and 30% there in one area. But that's the problem. It seems like the Muslims find themselves in the middle of a lot of troubled spots today. And it's my personal feeling that unless they are given some consideration, unless they are treated as an equal citizen of the world, and their group is given some consideration, I think we're going to continue to have trouble. They are concerned because, for one thing, the mandates and directives of the United States, they feel, are not applied equally. That some mandates, for example, Israel doesn't do them. Yet, anything against the Palestinians, yeah, you got to do them. I think we need to look at this as citizens of the world. How can you accommodate this diverse situation and hopefully keep what little tenuous peace we have? My generation, and I was talking to some young people at lunch today, I don't think we've done a very good job of managing the world, or managing the United States, not that I manage much of it. But in my generation, and I participated in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, if you want to count Panama, and a few other little conflagrations, they haven't done very well. I don't think we can go on like this. I have children and grandchildren, and I hope that there's some way that some people are smart enough to figure out how we can all live together. And that's why I'm up here, to try to get all of us aware that there is another culture out there.